Matan Torah, especially focusing on the issue of whether the Jews accepted the Torah voluntarily or involuntarily, is discussed in Shemos Yitzchak. If you read the account in the Torah, you can't avoid the conclusion that it was God's will that the Jews should decide for themselves whether they want to accept it or not. Because you see that the Torah describes when they arrived at Sinai, and they camped there, then it says that Moshe went up to God, and God called out to him from the mountain, and said, Kosam Olaveish Yaakov, the side of the Mesa. Tell the Jewish people, and Rashi, Chazal learned that Beish Yaakov is a reference to the women, and Bnei Yisrael is a reference to the men. So everybody has to be informed of this method. And that is that you have seen what I did to Egypt, and I carried you on the wings of eagles, and I brought you unto me. And now, if you will listen to my voice, and you will guard my covenant, then you will be unto me a treasure from all the nations, because the entire earth is mine. And you will be a kingdom of Kohanim and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to Bnei Yisrael. This is an extremely important message. And Rashi even comments on Eilah HaDvar and Pasuk Vav, which I think to be superfluous. There's no need to say these are the words. It's pretty clear that God is telling Moshe, he's already said, thus shall you say. So Eilah HaDvar, these are the words, is repetitious. It seems to be repetitious, and the Torah doesn't repeat something. So Rashi comments, Eilah HaDvar, lo pachos v'lo yoser, not more or less. Meaning that, which is saying, why would we assume that the Moshe would add or detract? The Moshe was the faithful servant of God. We take it for granted that Moshe will communicate exactly what God tells him. But I would say that there's an important point over here. That why over here would God be concerned that Moshe would add or detract? Okay? I mean, detracting is always a retract, rather. Moshe's obligation is to communicate the entire message. Anything, alright, maybe you'd want to add to it. That's more readily understandable. It's easier to understand that you might want to add to it. But the difficult to understand it anyway. He's not going to say over, he was told to say over. So let's just pause for a second to see if we can understand the rationale. The objective at this point is to show that the interpretation of Chazal is completely at variance with the plain meaning of the truth. So there's all different types of midrashim. Some of them are not at variance, they simply make a point, an emphasis. But this one, this the Eilah HaDvar, these are the words. Now when Chazal come along and say, what does it mean these are the words? Chazal doesn't just, speak in simplistic, terms. It communicates an idea. When they say not more, not less, that's fully in line. I mean, it's not contrary to the claim, you see? That's Pirush. This Chazal over here is Pirush, not more, not less. Eilah HaDvar. It's in line. Many midrashim speak very smoothly. They expand the text. They give you new insight into the text. A deeper thing. It's not contrary. For example, when it says by Moshe Rabbeinu that Vayitzen Tovacho, Vayarki Enish, he looked all around and said there was no man, and he slew the Egyptian. That's a different type of Chazal. It's interesting to classify the different types of Chazal. But the plain meaning is that he looked around and physically, we're talking in a concrete way to see if anybody was watching, because he didn't want to be observed when he killed the Mitzvah. The other Chazal would say that he looked with the Kodesh into the future and he saw the Enish, that there was no man destined to come from him. So now, is that a Chazal which is contrary to the... You have two interpretations now. One interpretation is practical, physical, concrete, the way we read the story. The other interpretation, using the same words, and the words fit nicely into the other interpretation, is not a totally different idea. If he's looking into the future and wants to see if there's an ish. There's any an ish over here doesn't just mean a physical person, it means somebody of significance, exotic. So that it would not be appropriate to kill this person for the sake of that individual in the future. Now, that's a different type of chazal. To me, that's not a shan. That's commensurate. That doesn't mean to say that that chazal is coming to negate pshat. It's not an argument as to what the meaning of the words are. It means that the Torah is written in such a way that it communicates that these two the statements God chose are perfect, and they communicate many different layers of ideas, and they all are in harmony with each other. So that Rashi would tell you this is not the plain meaning. He always says, nevertheless, ein hamikra yotze midei pshuto. We can't negate the pshat. The pshat communicates an idea. It's a very important idea. However, it also it alludes to a deeper idea. There's another idea as well. So both are true, but on two different levels. That is to say that to show you the greatness of Moshe, that Moshe did not act purely out of instinct, revenge, he's beating up a Jew, and as most people would look at it, he stood up for the Jew. It meant that Moshe was acting from a framework of justice, from consideration, and he thought it through, even to the extent that he thought through all the considerations of the future. Since he did have this capacity, Ruach HaKodesh, and he was able to gain an insight into the future, he took that into consideration as well. Now, all these are true, but did he actually look around to see if there was anybody? Well, of course he did. So there's a chazal which is commensurate, but it's adding a new dimension. It's not contradicting the plain meaning. Okay? The chazal we're going to do is in a different category. You'll find chazal that would seem to be contradicting the plain meaning. And then you have a real problem in terms of what's the truth. Or what, put it differently, what right does a chazal have to come along and change the plain meaning of the mikra? Now, just getting back to our question, Eila Hadvar, it just seems strange that in this particular situation, Moshe has to be instructed not to err or detract. This would indicate that this particular message is extremely important. And how are we to understand the specific injunction that Moshe shouldn't err or detract? Seems to me, because it is based upon God's will that the Jews, if this is the message, for the Jews to determine where they want to go from here. The next step. Do you want to accept the Torah or not? These are the terms. So God is presenting the terms to them for them to consider, as we subsequently see that Moshe came and he called the elders of the nation, which means that the message was intended not for the masses but for the leaders, for the elders, and he placed before them, interesting, doesn't say spoke and placed before them, which confirms that the placing before them would mean something which is exact, a text, a place before them. We didn't say spoke to them. Eish kol advarim eila, these words that God commanded. So don't we see clearly that God's intention was for them to receive the message? And not just the masses, but the elders, the chachamim, and to consider it, to think it over, and to arrive at a decision. You don't get any sense of God imposing the Torah upon them. Seems from here that it has to be their choice. Now, if that's the case, I think there was a need to say Eila Hadvarim, that Moshe was instructed not to add or not to detract, because it seems to me that from Moshe's standpoint, his objective would be to convince them to accept it. If Moshe In fact, when Moshe spoke to them, when he gave them rebuke, he said, what does God demand of you? What does God demand of you except to fear the Lord your God, do his commandments, and so on and so forth? Well, do I ask the question? It seems like he's making it like it's a very easy thing. So, I mean, what's the problem? He does a suit, is it a small thing? Just the manner of how Moshe addressed the Jews in the Bible. What does God want from you? Like, he has difficulty understanding why the people keep rebelling against the Torah. This makes the most sense. This is the most intelligent way to live. This is for your benefit. It's Torah law. You can't understand. Like, you can't understand that children keep fighting with you and trying to help them. So the Gemara says, yeah, for Moshe, it was a Zutta. For Moshe, it was a small matter. He was in such a level of perfection that it was just a natural thing to do. It was the correct thing to do. He couldn't perceive, couldn't imagine that a person could live any other way. Which is, that's the ultimate objective, that the Torah is the truth. The Torah is the truth. And each person is searching for the good. The truth in the sense, this is really what's the good. The only problem is that we have this distorted picture of the good, but if we could correct that and we could direct ourselves towards the good of the Torah, then we'd be beyond the issue of having to choose anymore. It would be natural. Once a person sees, everybody wants the best for himself. But once he sees what it is, he naturally gravitates to it. There's no question anymore. So if that's the case, then Moshe wanted to benefit the people. Of course Moshe wanted the Jews to accept the Torah. So then there are two ways that he could have related to this message. He could have amplified certain things. In other words, it was God giving him the message, and it was up to Moshe to deliver it. Sometimes, most of the time, you appoint an envoy to speak a spokesman. So if you trust him and he's intelligent and he understands psychology, so you tell him, these are my points. You say it over the way you have to say it over. You let them know what you're willing to give, what you're not willing to give, the bottom line, the basic position. But the negotiator is entrusted to express the way he wants. You want to add a little bit more of this element, and you want to play this down, but this is my bottom line. That's not the case over here. That Moshe was instructed just to communicate this exact text, not to add to it, because maybe he thought that there are certain points that should be added of his own to get it, because he knows the people and he wants to communicate. Or maybe he felt that certain points should be restricted, not stressed as much. You see what I'm saying? That's, I think, what the Havn Eilad Varn. That normally, or other, in other cases, when God told Moshe to communicate something to the Jews, it doesn't necessarily mean these exact words. It means this is the content. You use your judgment on how to communicate. So if you feel it's more important to stress these points, if you feel it's more important to tone down the other, tone down, it's fine. As long as you get the right, because there are different ways you can get the message across. But over here, it's Eilad Varn. And that's extremely important. Because it seems to me, this would be in line with my understanding of the text, that it was God's will that the Jews should choose of their own. On the basis of what? On the basis of their knowledge. On the basis of their relationship with God. All of what God has said, you have seen. On the basis of what they've experienced in Mitzrayim, and the Esa Eschem, Al-Kan Ken Sharam, and on the basis of the bris that I want to make a covenant with you, all the ideas, I'm going to have to go through the ideas. I'm not going through all the ideas that are contained in that message, but this is it. Don't add, you see, it's interesting with regards to what I talked about Kiva. I think I was discussing with Ellie about Kiva. But there are many rabbis today that say all kinds of strange things. They don't want to win people over, so they'll offer wild explanations about what the Torah is and what the reasons are, just that are appealing. They'll say things about Judaism that they know are very, very appealing, but whether they're true or not is a different issue. And they think the ends justify the means. as long as you win the guy over with this approach, kirov, so that's it, that justifies it. It doesn't matter what your philosophy is, or what you told the person. It seems from this text that God wanted the Jews to accept the Torah, that's for sure, but only to do so through their own choice, and that's based upon this information. There are many things you could say. That's why Moshe was instructed to sort of keep his own take on the situation out of it. Now, he would have presented it. He may have presented it differently, but God specifically instructed him, these are the words, these are the terms. And on the basis of these terms, look at yourself. And you see, there's always that temptation, but maybe they'll reject it. If I put it that way, if I put it a different way, I might make it more acceptable to them. But he was instructed not to make it more acceptable to them, to leave it on these terms. And the point I'm getting to is that it does seem that the will of God was for the Jews to accept it on the basis of these terms, not because of the mountain that was hanging over them. Vayanu kol ha'om yachdav, and the entire people answered. Now here it refers to the people. The only question is that in the previous pasuk it says Moshe was speaking to the Zipporah, and here you have the answer is being given by the people. Now I think that can be explained. It means that Moshe presented the idea to the Rishonim, and the Rishonim needed the consent. Wouldn't have been a good idea for the Rishonim to accept the Torah, which binds the entire nation. So they went and they communicated to the nation. And the response was a positive one. Kol ha-shadibar Hashem nasa. Everything that God had said we would do. So that's excellent. But there's no indication from here that they were forced, they were coerced. And then it says, Vayashev Moshe, as divrayam el Hashem. And Moshe brought back the words of the people to God. Of course, it wasn't necessary, God knew, but that's the way God relates to us, and we relate to God. That too would go contrary to the idea of God in the story that Chazal depicts, God, holding the mountain over them. It's not, God is there. It's not that God is somewhere else, so to speak. So if we can't attribute place to God. I'm just using the figuratively. That's the And then, by Yom Hashem Moshe, then God said to Moshe, "Hinei Anochi Barach Lecha B'Yadav Anon." Okay, now phase two. If the people have accepted it, they agree. So now, I'm going to manifest my existence to them. Above, they didn't even ask. It doesn't seem like they asked for that. But God said, "I'm going to come to you in the thickness of a cloud, in order that the people, the nation, will hear when I speak to you." God is going to demonstrate in an unequivocal way for all time exactly true. Anyone that uses his mind and thinks into the subject will be able to know that this is not just something we have to have faith in, but that the events of Sinai actually occur. The Gam Mechai Amin Liola, and also in you, meaning in Moshe Rabbeinu, which really Moshe Rabbeinu and all of those who follow after the Baal HaMasoreth. It means that it's going to set the foundation for our belief in the Torah Shebichsav, as it is interpreted by the Torah, by the Baal HaMasoreth, in accordance with the Torah Shebaal Peh. So, Vayaged Moshe es divrayam al Hashem. And Moshe then the pasuk is starting in order, what came first. But Moshe communicated the words of the Am to God. Then you have phase three, that God said to Moshe, go to the people, and they have to sanctify themselves, and to mark for 3 days, and wash their garments. So that since they're going to be on an elevated level, in which they are going to perceive this type of phenomenon, and they have to be on the highest possible spiritual level, so it requires preparation, so they have to separate themselves from their wives, and they have to wash their clothing, prepare themselves for this experience, and be prepared for the third day, for on the third day God will come down with any kalah, with the eyes of the entire nation. But this is the only time in history that God has made himself, manifested himself to the entire nation in an unequivocal manner, which leaves absolutely nothing to doubt. And Har Sinai. Let me tell you, just describe the instructions to the people to make boundaries around the mountain and have to go beyond each person, each group is limited to a certain boundary, how far they could go, and so on and so forth. And Moshe then goes, and Yudalad Moshe comes back from the mountain, and he prepares the people for the event, and tells them to be prepared for the third day, and do not, you have to separate from your wife, that's part of the sanctification. And then the third day. The third day, there was, in the morning, and there was already sounds of thunder, and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the call of the shofar was very powerful, and the people were trembling. People were trembling, and then you can't ask any questions. It's really a side point, because it's not my main focus right now, as to why they have to wash the clothing. So, I don't think it refers to all the clothing. It means that the clothing that they're going to be wearing on that day. So that's important. That is to say that clothing has a certain psychological effect upon the person. So, year before Shabbos, as you enter the Shabbos, the fact that it's the sanctity of the Shabbos, not Shechina, the presence of the Shechina, so you change. You're in a different state. So when a person recognizes that he's in a different state, so the clothing that he's wearing, a weekday is appropriate for one activity. The worker, the clothing is appropriate for work. He's not going to go to shul on Shabbos in that type of clothing. This is a different situation. So the clothing, clean clothing and so forth, reflects a certain state. It's an association, by association, a certain state of holiness. Hold off on a further. I have to investigate the washing of the clothing more thoroughly before I talk about it. Then it says that by Yotze Yitzrayim, and Moshe led the people towards God, not towards God directly, as it is euphemistically, it's the mountain where God caused himself to be manifested, a manifestation which reflects the existence of God. By Yisyatzvu, and they stood the Sakhti Sahar. That completes the description of everything which led up to the giving of the Torah. The next thing we hear about is the Torah that God comes down, so to speak, and they hear that voice which proclaims the Torah to Israel. Now, there's not the slightest indication over here that the Jews were coerced into accepting it. So I'm going to proceed to read from this article that comes off the internet on this issue. So the author writes, this well-known Adara is generally understood to mean that since only coercive threat convinced Am Yisrael to receive the Torah, it is possible to evade its obligation, as in the case of any commitment undertaken unwillingly. The Maharal understood to the contrary. In his view, the very inviolability of Torah stems from its inescapability. The Maharal seems to be saying that this is essential, that it's to the contrary, to the implication of the Gemara, that if it's accepted under duress, so you sort of have more of a defense, he's saying contrarily. This is the quote that he brings down from the Maharal. The reason that he held the mountain over them like a tub is so that Yisrael could not say that the Torah may be annulled. For had its acceptance depended on their agreement, it follows that rejection could be an option. Had they not been forced, it would have been possible to accept or not to accept. So he threatened them, saying in effect that they have no choice but to accept. And anything that is absolutely necessary cannot be revoked. I found in the Midrash, since the Holy One held the
the mountain over them like a tub. Oh, let's hold up a second. My interpretation of the quote, of what he's saying, is that basically you have to decide if this is something which is unchangeable, it's immutable, has to be this way, it can't be any other way. Or it could be a different way. In other words, what are we talking about? The Jews having the Torah. The Jews accepting the Torah. In other words, the question of whether it should be revoked or not depends upon this question. Is it something which is absolutely necessary, or is it something which is not absolutely necessary? It could have it A this way, it could have it the other way. Alright? If you're saying it's absolutely necessary, so then the Jews can have a revoke the Torah. If that's what he means, inviolable. If you're saying that it could have been otherwise, that the world can exist without the Jews accepting the Torah, so then the Torah is something which is conceivable, that the Jews could give it up, could renounce it. It's conceivable. That seems to be the argument. So therefore, if God would have made it a matter of choice, once you make it a matter of choice, you're saying you could go A this way and go the other way. So therefore, it's not absolutely essential. So therefore, the Holy One came along and removed it from being a matter of choice, and now there's no choice, meaning to say that there's no other way it could possibly be, and if there's no other way it could possibly be, so therefore it's inviolable, it's irrevocable. If it's absolutely necessary, it can't be revoked. Now, what determines whether it's absolutely necessary? Well, if you had a choice to begin with not to do it, then apparently it's not absolutely necessary. That's the argument. There are certain things where, let's say a parent and a child, there are certain things where there's no choice. It has to be this way. You can't allow the child to play with guns or whatever. That's an absolute. Because you recognize that it's impossible. It's an impossibility. You can't allow the child to drive the car, so on and so forth. Other things, you know. That's an absolute. Okay, so you realize those things where the parent does not give any choice whatsoever, they have an absolute character. You can't violate them. However, then there are things where the parent may give the child a choice. Okay? So if the child accepts it, the child accepts it a certain responsibility. Where the parent gave the child a choice, that there was a certain, and you accepted it, a certain responsibility upon yourself, so then you would say, well, there's more, if the child wants to get out of it, he has a basis, because he's saying it's not absolutely necessary that he do this thing. Because if it were absolutely necessary that he do this thing, it wouldn't have been a matter of choice. You would impose, there are certain things that the parent imposes on the child, must do, no choice whatsoever. Okay? That's it. Assuming the child's in charge, you call the train. If the child is trained, there's no longer any option. The child must use these facilities. Okay? That's not a matter of choice. That's an absolute. But then there are other things where the parent may give the child a choice. You want a job. You want to, do the lawn. Clean the lawn. Things of that sort. So with regard to that category of things, if the child argues and doesn't want to do it anymore, it has a certain basis. The parent can't maintain that this is an absolute. No, you can't. You can't exist here without that. If that were the case, then why was it a matter of choice to begin with? Those things which are absolute are not a matter of choice. Right? In the case of a parent and a child, I think the argument has validity. The argument has validity. It's not crazy. The argument. Now, it seems to me that he's making this argument to justify the statement of the Chazal that God could not have given the Jews a Torah on the basis of something which would be a choice on their part, because the very fact that it's a choice means it's not an absolute. And if it's not an absolute, then it can be revoked. So since he took it into the realm of no choice, so now you can't revoke it. If it's an absolute, then it's absolute and does it. I only think that even according to this, they did have a choice. They did have a choice. Because it wasn't such a great choice, they didn't have too much room to maneuver. It was, it's much less room now. It's like an offer, as we said, it's an offer that they couldn't refuse. Yeah, but the question is an offer they couldn't refuse, but still they could have said, go right ahead and wipe us out. Even according to Chazal. even according to Chazal. No, but I think that he would argue and say, if they would have achieved that, and they wouldn't exist. Which means that their whole existence was because they had no choice. If you want to exist, this is the way it has to be. If not, you won't exist. That's what Chazal is saying. So a guy, this is in line. But that's his point. His point is that God presented it to them as all or nothing. Now, of course, now since the Jews are the ones that have to keep the Torah, they have to decide. That much choice he gave them. Because beyond that, you'd have to say that God made them into robots. You see, that's not God that programmed people to act. God gave man the ability, the talent of Akim, that component within him which has the capacity to understand all the options and to make choices. That's why we're responsible. So that's not going to change. Anything more than, this is the minimal expression of choice. But the alternative is death. He's trying to explain why what we would think is a good thing, Nasim, the Jews said Nasim and Ishmael, that their willingness of their own accord to accept that it was not good. That wasn't good, because then it still would be something which you're doing because you accept it. And it's better if you're doing it because you're compelled. Yeah. See, I maintain that the fact that God gave him a choice doesn't mean that it's not absolutely necessary. It is absolutely necessary. It's absolutely necessary in the sense that without the Torah, without man living the proper life that God intended for him, then there's no purpose for the man's existence, and there's no purpose for the world's existence. So in that sense, the Torah is absolutely necessary. However, the fact that something is entered into voluntarily does not in any way detract from the fact that it's absolutely necessary. That's something else. The reason why it's like, so why does God give man a choice? That's because it's God's will that man should relate to the good through choice. I'll give you an example. Is man's good behavior, that man should behave good and not do evil, is that absolutely necessary? And you see from the story of the flood that it's absolutely necessary. That God saw that the evil of man had increased, the entire world was filled with corruption, and God said he's going to destroy mankind. Alright, today because of Noah, he didn't destroy mankind. But had there not been a Noah, according to the simple understanding, had there not been a Noah, so then God would have destroyed the world. Why? Because man was evil. So therefore so man's evil is an absolute phenomenon. And man's being good is an absolute requirement, right? Yeah, but God didn't force it upon them. The fact that God doesn't force something upon us is not because the thing is not necessary. It is necessary in terms of God's will of how things should be. But the reason why you have the element of voluntary is because it's God's will that man should choose that which is necessary as a result of his free will. That's why, you see, so there is no contradiction. There's no contradiction between the way in which I relate to something and whether it's binding or not. The Torah is equally binding. And by the way, I can show you many examples of that. The fact that something is entered into voluntarily in no way does not detract from the binding character. For example, Yaakov wants to assure that Yosef would not bury him in the trunk. Would not bury him in the trunk. And he was concerned that he might be forced by pressures to bury him in the trunk. So what did he do? He elicited a shvuah from him. Alright? Now, Yosef entered into the shvuah voluntarily. You have a choice, correct? Yeah, but it's in the very carry. Once you enter into it, you can't say, well, I entered into it voluntarily. I'm not bound to keep it. To the contrary, something is binding in character. You enter into something which is binding in character. So the more I could show that you did it of your own accord, the more bound you are by it. And the more you can argue that I didn't know what I was doing, I was compelled into it, I didn't know what I was signing, so that's an argument on his side. But the fact that it's binding stems from the nature of the commitment. There are commitments in life whose very nature is binding. A person volunteers for the army. and then he's found to be sleeping while, you know, court martial. He can't argue then and say, well, I mean, I didn't have to volunteer. I volunteered. It's true, you didn't have to. But by as a result of your act of volunteering, you now became a soldier, and these are the responsibilities of a soldier. You see? He's not saying that God did not want to give them a choice because they might have refused it. That's not what he's saying. If you want to say that, then you can say fine. But apparently God, so to speak, didn't care about that. If they refused it, they refused it. He's saying, and they accepted it though. The truth is that they accepted it. That's what the pasuk is saying. But that wouldn't have been good, because it would have been based upon acceptance. And anything which is based upon acceptance is not absolute. I'm maintaining no. That it's absolute, but the way in which you relate to it can be, just because you relate to it through something, voluntary means, you're not forced into it, doesn't change the character of the commitment. The commitment, once you make the commitment, you're bound by your commitment. It's in the very character. The commitment to Torah resides in the nature of the commitment. That once we accepted it for ourselves, for our children, forever and ever, and it's in the nature of that commitment. So you have no basis for arguing anymore that you accept it voluntarily. And then you have to make a distinction. The fact that the Jews should keep the Torah is the absolute will of God. So why didn't he impose it upon them? That's because of a different reason, because that's because of the phenomenon of free will. So you can always ask that question. Is it God's will that I should behave? Is it God's will that I should do good? Of course it is. So why did God make me do good? Why didn't God give me a natural impulse to do good? That's what everybody has. Why did God give me all these different desires? The answer is not that in no way detracts. See, it's either God really doesn't care if I do good or don't do good, because if he really cared about my doing good, he wouldn't have given me any options. The answer is that his will that you should do good is absolute. But the reason why you have the ability to do otherwise is because of the phenomenon of free will. That's his will. It's his will that you have to be the cause of your own goodness, that you have to make a choice. You have to live in the world of choice. But that in no way detracts from the fact that the inviolability, so to speak, the absoluteness of God's will, that this is what you should do. And it will not change any of the consequences. If you choose evil, it will not in any way diminish the consequences, because you'll say, well, I had a choice. It wasn't, obviously, it could not have been that important, otherwise God wouldn't have given me any choice. No, that's the essence of free will. This other verse we're talking about a separate point, and that is, because we're talking about the next argument in the quoted in the name of Maharal, that an honor, that when somebody rapes a girl, so the punishment, even though he too late to rehabilitate himself, but punishment is based on justice, and that is that he has to always repair the damage that he did. And in that type of a society, the damage is, with regard to her chances of prospects for marriage, that since she has this taint, she won't be able to be married. So to address that, the Torah obligates him to marry this woman and to save her from that state, and he can't divorce her all of his life, assuming that's what she wants. Of course, if she doesn't want to marry him, the compulsory element only applies to him. He's obligated to marry her, if that's what she would desire. I maintain that that is a very serious punishment, and a person might, if you think about it, at first glance, you look at it emotionally, say, well, what if he cares about this guy? He deserves whatever they give. Throw the book at him. But I maintain that it's a serious punishment, because usually it's much more than a monetary thing. Even if there's a serious monetary fine, even if he goes to jail for 5 years, he's going to still have his life. Now, that's one of the major areas in a person's life. Who he wants to be married to. That's one of the most significant choices that a person has to make, and one of the most important elements in determining your whole life. That area should be approached very seriously. Unfortunately, people don't, because they approach it with their emotional, program. Each person has or agenda, whatever it is, each person has programmed to be attracted to certain types of women. That doesn't mean that these women are necessarily good for them. But it's one of the most important elements in the success or failure of a person's life, who he happens to marry to. So here, if you analyze it, you might even make the case that it's a person. It's true, he's thin, true, he violated her, but it shouldn't be like a life sentence. In a sense, it's like a life sentence. Because let me tell you that, you know, being forced to be married to someone who's not really right for you is like being a life sentence in jail. And I'm going to think about that. That can ruin a guy. And that, nevertheless, you see the extent to which the Torah is based upon the principle of justice. Because that's the chait. The chait is that he robbed her of an opportunity to be married. That's the chait. And as a result of that, she has to, if she shows her desire. She thinks well and she says yes, she wants to marry to him, because she looks around and she says that her chances of getting a good shidduch are not very good. So that he's mechuyev to marry her and he can't do anything. And that's interesting enough, I think, would function as a deterrent. That would definitely be a deterrent if these laws were strictly enforced. Alright, so just, I want to make a side point over here, because we got into a side issue about deterrence. And I mentioned the point, there's something in the news right now, it's controversial, that the New York policy that the person is caught for drunk driving, so they take away his car. It's New York City. I'm not getting into the legalities of it, that's a kind of complex issue, whether that's legitimate or legal or not. To take away a person's property because he committed this crime. So, ignoring that, it just seems to me, however, that this is a serious problem. That it's a person who's doing that, he's acting in a very, very reckless kind of a way. He's like, in a sense, it's gambling with people's lives. It's the mentality of a murderer. Think about that. This is something which, by the way, now that the perm is around the corner, people should take it very, very seriously. Seriously, because people have a tendency to get drunk. They have one mystery, they really need to indulge in, you know, like put down that that a person should drink a little bit more, you know, the sooner. So everybody takes people the license to get crazy drunk, which is not. Just the idea, however, Mark is saying that the severity of the punishment is not necessarily a deterrent. As in England, they used to hang pickpockets, and the story goes that after hangings, it would attract more pickpockets. You see that the fact, and that seems to be a very severe penalty for something, you know, rather minor. The issue of whether something serves as a deterrent, in my opinion, is not simple, and I think a lot has to do with the mentality of the individual that it's directed at. Because you do see, as Mark points out, that the people, in spite of all the dangers associated with drugs, continue to take drugs, and it destroys their lives, they become addicted. And I was mentioning, and even with regard to the phenomenon of AIDS, which seems to be the biggest account, the worst horrible nightmare imaginable, and yet when this became known, it did not deter people from engaging in the rest of behaviors that bring it about. So what is this teaching? It's about the nature of man. Sometimes you just study what the world around you, to learn tremendous from the world around you. Because it's all, that's not, the people that are engaging in that are not like from Mars, they're human beings. So whatever they have, we partake of the same character, nature, unless we discover something, and then we should apply it to ourselves. That's the basis, the fact that the Torah recognizes that an intelligent person can live can learn from the laboratory of life, of human life. That's the halacha that makes seva tokum. It's the halacha which is based upon this, that you have to give respect to a seva, to an old person, even if he's not necessarily a talmud chacham. Yadarta k'nei zakei means kavod to a talmud chacham. Zakei means nisha kana chachma. It doesn't mean old, even if he's young. Zeshe kana chachma. So it's someone who's a talmud chacham, even if he's young. And seva, even if he's old. A person who's very old, even if he's not a talmud chacham. Because the Gemara says that he's gone through all those experiences, and that represents a form of knowledge. You're just experiencing enough life, if you're an observer, you'll learn a great deal. So I think the point is that you have to be aware of the fact that people have a tremendous capacity for denial. And I think this is very based upon a certain emotion of invincibility, and invincibility translates into, like, beyond the laws of nature. When a person has that emotion overtaken, very, very dangerous. Because he's going to be engaging in behaviors and activities where the odds are really stacked against him, and he denies, he's in a state of denial. So therefore, it's true that a person, like a pickpocket, is a certain culture, it's a certain mentality, and each one assumes that he's not going to get caught. But the criminal, crime doesn't pay, basically. The criminal's going to get caught. But so why is the mafia, why are they engaging him? Because they're in a state of denial. My point over here is that the average driver, however, may not be in that state of denial with regard to the fact that he'll be caught by the police, in other words. For those people who have this mentality, you're right. For those people who have the mentality that they're beyond the law, invincibility, you know, they can drink, and it's like sort of like a macho kind of thing, but they can drink as much as they want and drive, you know, and all that, so you're right. I don't know if it'll be the turn. But for the average, the ordinary person, that doesn't have this type of an emotion, but he might, you know, he might be out at a party and have a couple of drinks, and he might not think twice normally about getting into the car. That person will be scared, because he's not in a state of denial. So I think that whether or not a penalty is effective vis-a-vis an individual depends upon his state. Whether he's in a state of reality with regard to this, he's going to enter the If he's in a state of denial with regard to this, then it's not. Maharal then bolsters his position. The Torah had to be imposed on the Jews, because once it is imposed, it can't be broken. He uses as a support the fact that in Onos, when a man rapes a woman, so then he's forced to marry her. And since he's forced to marry her, he can't break it. Can't break it. Is that substantiate his case in any way? That's my question to you. This is, we just read what he said. Now your task is to analyze it and to see whether it does support the argument or it doesn't. With Eliot's criticism, in the analogy, it doesn't seem to hold. First of all, the fact that you can't break a marriage is not because of the fact, it's not because it was enforced. Maybe it was involuntarily, it's because of punishment. How do you draw the analogy? That is a punishment which the Torah imposes, the punishment, therefore he has no choice. And the reason why he can't send her away is because that's part of the very punishment itself. So we're talking about a punishment. But how can you draw an analogy from here to the case of God giving us the Torah and God forcing us? Because if you want to say that in that sense we are raped, quote unquote, obviously, it doesn't follow the analogy, because as Ellie pointed out, the woman who's raped is not coerced as a result of that. She has the right to reject the marriage. So therefore, if that's the case, if in the analogy, call yourself as the bride, you know, because I'll talk about that, that we are betrothed to God, so then it doesn't hold, because in the case of the rapist, it is the rapist who doesn't have choice. The woman has choice. He doesn't have choice because that's a punishment, and it just doesn't seem to fit the analogy at all. It doesn't fit the analogy at all, and I don't know why you can make a simple case. The simple case is that a woman enters into a marriage voluntarily. And then once she enters into it, she's mekudeshet. And kedushin means that she becomes nasar, prohibited to the entire world. And that's inviolable. There's no exception to it. And if she should engage in adultery, she can't bring forth the argument that, well, she really didn't have to marry him in the first place. You see, but something which is entered into voluntarily, nevertheless, can create absolute results which are binding in all circumstances, once she entered into it. So therefore, that's my argument, contrary to this, that there was no need then for God to impose the Torah upon us. But God could have given us the choice, but have told us that this is your choice. But once you accept it, now, I have a proof. I have a proof. It seems to me the case of Ger is very instructive, because you know the attitude of Yad is to the Ger, is basically ambivalent. But when a person first comes to convert, we don't just not, like any other religion, start to snatch him. To the contrary, we sort of discourage him. There's a policy of discouraging him. And basically the reason being is that we're suspicious that maybe he has the wrong motive.
What policy
is there? The reason, no, because there's a concern. The person is only permitted to convert for one reason, because the truth. He wants to be part of the Jewish people, not just non-part of the Jewish people, so he can marry somebody. It's because he recognizes that this is the superior way of life. He wants to be part of that nation which God has designated to live the correct way of life. Now he goes, as he says, he goes through the process. But before we actually go through with it, we tell him, you don't have to do this. Bear in mind, he has to be warned about the consequences, that today you can do whatever you want. You can eat shrimp, you can get any food, you can do work on the Shabbos, and so on and so forth. And all these cases, and nothing, you're not doing anything wrong, you're not to be punished. If you, tomorrow, you're going to be held accountable. Once the person, so this is purely voluntary, and once the person goes through that process voluntarily, it's irrevocable. You cannot go back. If he says that's it, he made a mistake, whatever the case may be, it doesn't matter. It will not help him one iota. He will be subject to the Michal Shabbos and the witnesses and so on and so forth. He'll get the death penalty. And he can never claim that I accepted it out of choice. I volunteered. Since I volunteered, why should I be held to such a high standard? As far as I'm concerned, though, I don't find the argument convincing in any way, shape, or form that if the Jews were unleashed him, if the Jews were forced, so then it's binding, and if it's voluntary, then it's not binding. And again, by the way, that goes contrary to the Gemara itself, because the Gemara itself makes the statement that now that the Jew, according to this, if you go through the Gemara itself says that, oh, now that you're telling me that it was imposed on them, so now they have a good defense, they can defend themselves and say, if they violate the Torah, then we shouldn't be held accountable because we never accepted it in the first place. So you see, the Gemara is going in the opposite direction. That it's the more you're going to say that something is imposed, the less binding. And that's common sense. That's our common sense. That no one is going to feel bound by something if he didn't obligate himself to do it. If I asked you to watch something and you said, I can't guarantee you, I'm just, I'm going in and out. I happen to be there, while I'm there. I mean, I'll take a look at it, but I'm not taking the responsibility. I refuse to take responsibility. And they're like, okay, I'll try, rely on that, whatever, that's good enough for me. And then if the object is stolen, I can't take you to court. I can't argue, you have an obligation. I told you, I didn't have an obligation. On the other hand, if you do accept, and you say, yes, I accept the obligation, so then you're bound. So that's, again, this argument, this approach is very, very difficult, as far as I'm concerned. This is you and the issues we've been discussing, starting up with the Chazal, that's quoted. The biggest problem with the Chazal of that time, that is to say that God sent a mountain upon them and threatened them, that he would kill them and so forth, they didn't accept the Torah. The biggest problem is that where is this coming from? It seems to go contrary to the account from the Torah. The Torah, that's the major problem with the Chazal, in my opinion, is that it goes contrary to the plain account, which indicates that God negotiated, so to speak, with the Jews, that God presented the position, the benefits, the reasons why they should accept the Torah, but there was no threat. You don't find any threat. And the implication that you would raise is that if the Jews refused, they refused. And then you can say, well, what would have happened to God's whole plan? That's a good question, but that question comes up in many places. We see by the golden calf that the God wanted to destroy the people and create a new nation out of Moshe. But God indicated to Moshe that there was one possibility left, that if he would rise to the occasion and he would relate to God with the prophet's philos, then God would say, Heraphim. And God said, leave me alone, and I'll destroy them. So why do you say leave me alone? You know, Moshe is not holding on to him in a physical way. So it means God communicated to him that if you don't leave me alone, there is a way. So then Moshe concluded that the matter is contingent upon me. There's one way, there's one possibility left to save the Jewish people. Of course, this does presuppose the possibility that it would not have happened. Since Moshe Rabbeinu was a human being and he operates with free will, if he did not rise to that level, if he did not do the appropriate thing, then it sort of presupposes that the consequences would have been a destruction of the Jewish people. Now, of course, most people can't accept that. It had to happen. But if you're saying it had to happen, then you're denying the whole principle of free will. So, I mean, I know it's troubling for people, because people can't imagine a scenario in which anything else would have happened except the way it is. I made the point months ago, and I was being far at the time, was around Park Snow, and I gave a talk, and that in a sense we owe our physical existence to one person, to Noah, because God has made this for the entire world. And that's what the Torah says. God was prepared to be, how do you understand such a thing? And Noah was a king. Noah found a favor. Which means that Noah was a righteous person. Okay? And he was uncorrupted by the generation, by the evil of that generation. Yeah, but what if he would not have done? What if Noah didn't have to be that way? Does that mean that God removed his free will, that God forced Noah to be a good person, so that there'd be one good person who would find favor? That whole idea doesn't make any sense at all. Because then why would God find favor? You see? In fact, what does it mean God finds favor? God finds favor when a person fulfills his purpose through utilization of his free will. But God doesn't find favor with someone who just is let's assume someone is operating correctly, but he's lost his free will. He's been hypnotized. He's been programmed to do the correct thing. So we would not find that God found favor. Because God only finds favor with the good. And the good is only something which is a result of man's tefillah, the proper use of his tefillah. That's a fundamental of fundamentals. Can't get around that. And then my point was, let's say there wouldn't have been enough. Okay? So, I mean, what would happen? So God would destroy the world. Because God said, I'm prepared to destroy the world. So in spite of the fact that it's God's will that there should be a world, on the one hand, it is not, one can say that it's inevitable, but it must happen that there will be a world. Well, that God's will, it means that that's God's will. If there's only going to be a world, if man exercises the proper utilization of his free will, only under those conditions. So that doesn't mean that God's will would even be God's will of this world. It's God's will. God created man, so how could that be? That's an astounding question. To find a book which actually writes about God being a supreme being, believe me, no religion would ever have to explain that. Because if any religion which is based upon man's imagination and beautification, God always wins. You see? That's the Superman. God can't lose, so to speak. I'm using all these terms descriptively. So how could the Torah present a situation where it would seem, one second, God failed. And he says it's God regretted. The terminology is very powerful, that God regretted the Torah goes so far as to depict God as though God actually regretted. How can you have such concepts with the supreme being? Or the rock has worked up perfect. That doesn't mean God does it perfect. Well, what do you mean God is ready? It didn't work. It failed. And that's what would have happened if there would not have been enough. I mean, the idea of regret is not to be taken literally, because God doesn't have regret. It's an emotion. But the truth that is conveying, okay, that is to say that the decision that there should be a world has been rescinded. That is true. That is true. Can that be reconciled with the idea of God as being perfect, and as a result of his perfection, his works are perfect? Everything that in God's order was all Tov. So if it was all Tov 1 minute, then how could it be Rock Kalayom, only evil the next minute? I'm maintaining that this is another element in the uniqueness of Torah, that our concept of God is possible. But in any type of a man-made religion, this doesn't happen, because in the man-made religion, that God is this Superman. You see? This magnified Superman. And that's the essence of God. That God will, that God, the false God that man creates, is absolute. Whatever he wants happens, and there's nothing to stand in his way. These types of things would never occur. That's my opinion. What I was saying is correct. The reference there, interestingly enough, if you take a look at it carefully and voracious, it says after every unit of creation, and God saw that it was good. But after the creation of Adam, it does not say that, and God saw that it was good. And it says that God saw that it was good. Now it is true that it doesn't say that specifically with regard to man. But just then afterwards it says God saw that all he created, and he was telling him, oh, it was very good. Okay, but there is no mission and inclusion. In a sense, when God created man, it can't really... The statement cannot be said of God so that it was good in the same way that the statement can be said about the other elements of creation. See, because in those other elements of creation, good means that they reach their objective. That's what good is. Good means it's in line with the purpose. We have to divest ourselves of false notions of perfection. This is something that troubles a lot of people. Even on a psychological level, they're always operating with a certain idea of trying to be perfect, the perfect this, the perfect student, the perfect child, the perfect father, the perfect friend. And this is a notion which can be very, very problematic. It causes a lot of distress. Because if you're operating with a false idea of what you ought to be, if it's false, you're never going to be that which you think you ought to be, so you're always going to be in a state of unhappiness. Just at certain moments in your life, you feel you got it. But it's not going to stay that way, because since you have a false idea of what you ought to be, you're always going to be in a state of misery. That's a big problem, by the way. That plagues many people. People of conscience. But they never feel they're good enough. A lot of religious people partake in this disease. A lot of religious people partake of this, I know that. And they're sincere people. I'm not criticizing. To the contrary, I think they can help them. A lot of people struggle to be mitzvahs and to learn and better, and they're really sincere, and yet they're always troubled. They can't enjoy life. They're miserable. They always feel they're not good enough. Because they're operating with a false idea of what the perfected person ought to do, and it's one which is, again, borrowed from somebody else is by comparison. So it does partake of the Lo Sachnot syndrome, although it's not a violation of Lo Sachnot. And that's, to a large extent, the religious establishment today promotes that idea with all these autobiographies of the development which seeks to paint them like sort of super human beings. They've never had a bad thought, they've always naturally wanted to do the good, they wouldn't waste a minute on Batala, you know, and then the person gets the idea, well, man, I feel sick, look at me, I'm not sick at all. I'm a million miles away. The yeshiva is to try to implant that type of a superego in a person. Man, that can wipe you out. The purpose is not go to the other extreme of laziness and you take it easy and relax. And then they say, well, okay, that's the best of my ability. That's absurd too. Either extreme is absurd, the person's got a realistic. It's essential that a person has a realistic capacity to assess his own abilities, because that's a given. He's not going to be more, he can't transcend himself. And all human suffering comes from the attempt to transcend yourself, to be more than what you are. And look, the Chazal always emphasized that point, that the Yiftach B'doro is Kishmur B'doro. And the Rambam says in the Shmona Prakam that each person has the capacity to be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. And yet at the same time, you know that the Yom Ha'adi will come to Moshe. There will never be another Moshe. It means to say that a tzaddik is measured, it's a relative concept, that perfect means to be, to fulfill the purpose, to be in the most appropriate state for what you are. So therefore, it depends upon your makeup, and each person has a unique, particular, individualistic makeup, and he has to operate with that. He can't operate by somebody else's makeup. This is a crucial element in development, and it's not stressed enough in the educational system. Dan is raising the issue of role models. I agree 100%. That's the part of the Torah. By the Rebbe, all the laws that prescribe the relationship to the Rebbe, and not just to learn, but to the Mishanos, the Rebbe, that is to say, to spend time, to try and spend time with him and see how he lives and how he addresses all of his issues in life, because it's not just Torah. You see? Torah is more than, it's not just the root of Torah, but how a person applies it to every aspect of life. Every aspect of life is Torah. It's not limited to one area. So you need a role model. Interestingly enough, when many people adopt a role model, then they seek to just emulate and copy him, to be him. To be another version, you'll see, like, if a Rebbe, especially if he has a very overpowering personality, the students begin to try and, like, imitate him, even physically, and try and talk to him. Like, to talk the way he talks, and everything. And just, and talk, and be. That is not necessarily the objective. The role model is the model. If this is the ideal, a person who's living in this type of a way, in a general kind of a way, the control of the emotions, the utilization of karma, the involvement in chesed, and so on and so forth. But that's him, and that's unique. But you have to apply that model to yourself. You see? It may not, the ultimate expression may not come out the same way. Maybe he's, in his framework, his role is to be the Talmud Chacham and the Rebbe and the teacher and he learns 15 hours a day and teaches. But for you, maybe that same role model is that you should work half the day and learn a few hours and do some community work. I mean, in each case, you understand, the basic ingredients are the same. The involvement in Torah, the proper study of Torah, the perfection of the self, it's all the same. But the manifestation now has to be applied. You can't escape that. You can't escape the challenge of the distance of becoming somebody else. But the truth is, the Talmud leading to the contrary, that he'll go beyond the Rebbe, that he does have the capacity to be a Talmud Chacham, and he could be a great Talmud Chacham than a Rebbe. Really. So why should you, it doesn't limit that. But if you're going to limit, just try to imitate, you're not going to have such a phenomenon. That's why, interestingly enough, you see Elokei Avraham. They say Elokei Avraham Yitzchak of Yaakov, they say Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, but they weren't carbon copies. Each one had a very unique understanding, relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the extent that it could be said, oh, okay, Yitzchak. So that was not the objective of Avraham, was to raise someone who simply was a clone, who simply followed another version of Avraham. Yitzchak was not another version of Avraham. Chazal made that clear. There were differences. For example, Yitzchak wasn't permitted to leave the land. You know, you're Ola Tamima. To complete the whole, like an Ola, Karban Ola, and that Avram left the land, and Yaakov left the land. Each one was unique, was different, they were not clones. The Torah over here is in reference to the will of God, which we really can't question. Most of the problems that we encounter in the world stem from the fact that man is possessed of free will. And therefore, that creates the possibility of evil. Evil is something which can only be predicated of man. You can't predicate evil of an animal. See an animal, a beast of prey, and chasing this poor little deer, and tearing it apart, that's not evil. That's good. That's the way it was intended. That's the system. It appears to us that way, that's not evil. Evil can only be predicated of man. And when we speak about evil, we mean in the sense that he's not in line with his purpose. He's not fulfilling his purpose. That's evil. That's the whole idea of evil. And that's the, why the angels, when they sang Shiva, they wanted to sing Shiva by the arm. So they were rebuked. If God said, Masa Yodai, told them the arm. But this is not good. This is not cause for happiness. It's the church that chose a failure. This is my creation. They didn't do. They were down in the sea. That means they did not achieve their purpose. That's not good. However, it is the divine will that there should be a being who relates to the Creator, who's an instinctual being and an intelligent being. Somehow these two are combined in a manner which only divine wisdom could dictate, determine. And that being should have relations to that level. Beyond that, I don't think we can understand why that has to be the case. I don't know that it's possible to explain why it was the divine will that created being like this. Chazal bring down that this is a very difficult thing to understand. They said that the heavenly court was arguing with God. So they don't fear. That's why one of the interpretations is Nasa. Let us. To depict it as though, obviously, there is no heavenly court debating with God. God doesn't have any advisors. That's a given. Given that is God's will that there should be a being. That's good. Because now there's a being, a physical being, who has the possibility of reaching this level of Yedius Hashem through his own choice. That's a good. That's a good. The only reason why the Torah doesn't specifically say at that point in reference to man that it's good is because man is not in that state by nature. Every other being is in a state of good, meaning good simply means in line with its purpose. And evil means not in line with its purpose. And every other being is naturally in line with its purpose, because its purpose is programmed into its nature. And in man, it's not programmed into his nature due to the fact that he has the Bechira. So it cannot be said of man per se. We'll see. We'll see. Man, by nature, is not good, and by nature is not evil. By nature, he's a being that's forced to confront the reality of the situation and to choose. And he's defined as being good or evil on the basis of the choice that he makes. That's the whole challenge of human existence. That's why, you see, that's why when God gave man free will, God created the possibility that he would be rescind human existence. Because we exist only because of the will of God. And the will of God attaches itself only when we live in a human fashion. When the entire world ceases to live in a human fashion, and mankind decides to live in an animalistic fashion, so then there's no being of man. So God, then there's no physical existence anymore. God rescinds it. See? Those are mistakes. That does not mean, you see, that doesn't mean God made a mistake. It was God's will to create such a being. But God gave this being the capacity to, so to speak, self-destruct. Because that's part and parcel, that's how serious the extent of the significance of free will, and the process of free will, you take seriously. All that is true.